Listening to Reciprocity Radio. This is Amanda, your host, here every Sunday at 5 on Radio Free Brooklyn. This is a show about food, cooking, eating, drinking, everything on your table, recipes, all that kind of stuff. Welcome. Thanks for tuning in. You first heard Judy Collins with a version of Bread and Roses. It's a song about the Bread and Rose protest, and it's a little hint of what I'm doing here today. I'm going to be covering several different holidays, including my own birthday, because that's just how it happened every year this time of year. I was born on Friday, on the 3rd. May Day is May 1st. Derby Day is always the first Saturday of May, so that was on the 4th. And today, I think we all know, is Cinco de Mayo here in the U.S., so I'm going to be talking about all of those things. So I'm going to have to basically crack our knuckles and dive right in. May Day, if you don't know, is the International Workers' Rights Day. It's also a festival that has been taking place for ages. When I was a kid, I knew May Day is like a maple and it's spring. It's not like, it's not really unlike the Swedish holiday of Midsummer, and sort of like, you're like celebrating flowers and spring and all that stuff. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll talk about the International Workers' Day. which is what that beautiful song Bread and Roses is about, which is sort of just saying you should have enough leisure time to and enough sustenance, so you should have the means to work, the means to eat, the means to have leisure, just the bread and the roses. So, but May is chocked full of spring activities, so let's get into it. May Day is an ancient spring festival. It is a traditional holiday in many cultures. Dancing, singing, and cake are usually part of the festivals, and in the late 19th century, the day was adopted as a chosen date for the International Worker Day by socialists and communists, and it is also that day is referred to May Day, so we kind of, it's both. The earliest known celebrations of May Day were called the Floralia, or the Festival of Flora, the Roman goddess of flowers, and that was held from the 27th of April to the 3rd of May during the Roman public era, and the Mauma Festival, celebrating Dionysus and Aphrodite, held every 3 years during the month of May. The Floralia opened up the theatrical performances. Opened up with them. Anyway. Sorry, having a little trouble with Spotify. It was celebrated at least as early as the 2nd century AD, when records show expenses for the month-long festival were appropriated by Emperor Commodus. According to 6th century chronicles of John Molellus, the Mauma was a nocturnal dramatic festival held every 3 years, known as orgies, that is, the mysteries of Dionysus and Aphrodite, and it was known as the Mauma's because it was celebrated in the month of May Artemisios. During this time, enough money was set aside for the government to light torches and cover other expenses for the 30-day festival of all-night revels. A later May festival celebrated by Germanic countries, Walpurgisnacht, this commemorates the official canonization of Saint Walpurga on May 1st, 870. In Gaelic culture, the evening of April 30th was celebrated with the festival Beltane, or which translates into lucky fire, to start the summer season. The first attested in 900 AD, the celebration mainly focused on the symbolic use of fire to bless cattle and other livestock as they moved to summer pastures, and the custom continued into the early 19th century, during which time cattle would be made to jump over fire to protect their milk from being stolen by fairies. So that is some of the things that have happened. Since the 18th century, many Roman Catholics observed May Day with various May devotions to the Blessed Virgin Mary and works of art, and at school skits and so forth. Mary's head will often be adorned with flowers and a May crowning. And May is one of the two feast days of the Catholic patron saint of Saint Joseph the Worker, a carpenter, husband to Mother Mary, and the surrogate father of Christ. So that's a lot of stuff that's loaded on to this day, but it is now sort of, I think, at least more commonly amongst my peers, recognized as International Workers' Day, and Labor Day. That's exciting. And celebrates laborers and working classes that is promoted by the International Labor Movement, which occurs, of course, every May 1st. The date was chosen by a pan-national organization of socialist and communist political parties to commemorate the Haymarket Affair, which occurred in Chicago on May 4th in 1886. In 1904, the 6th Conference of the Second International Call on all social democratic party and organizations and trade unions called on all social democratic party organizations and trade unions of all countries to demonstrate energetically on the first day of May for the legal establishment of the 8-hour day, for the class demands of the proletariat, and for universal peace. So, the origin came from labor movements, obviously. And May 1st was chosen to... I'm repeating myself here. So now we know we've gotten through in the first 10 minutes, the first holiday of this season. I was really curious also, since the original May Day is sort of in several different variations of celebrated flowers, I started thinking about the cherry blossoms, because it was Hatsume Festival at... a Sakura Hatsume at the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens the weekend previous to this one, and I went on Friday, the day of my birthday, and it was really beautiful, and And it was just, I loved it. I go every year. And I was curious because in Japan, sakura or cherry blossoms is often eaten, or it's often a flavor. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that because contrary to the name, it's not a cherry. There are no cherries that are going to grow on those trees. It's just how it's called. So let's talk a little bit about the flowers real quick here. The sakura have begun to bloom, and there is hardly a more attractive time to visit Japan or anywhere here, like Brooklyn Botanical Gardens or the wonderful gardens in D.C. Petals are covering the nation as friends and family gather for the week of hanami or flower viewing parties. It's times like this that the sakura-flavored goods start to fill the shelves, and that's right, in Japan, the love for this bloom doesn't stop merely at looking at them, they also enjoy eating the blossoms and leaves. Each year, leaves and blossoms are picked from trees and preserved in salt to be consumed later. If you have a chance to try something sakura-flavored, just go for it, but be aware it's not going to taste like cherries. Sakura means cherry blossoms, but it will not taste like fruits. The taste of actual blossoms is very floral and does not taste anything like a sour cherry or a sweet cherry. Previously, the preserved flowers were used in sakura-yu, a kind of tea made by simply floating a blossom or two in plain boiling water. The clear, faintly pink tea is slightly salty and slightly sour, which makes for a nice change from green or black tea. Nowadays, you can find the preserved blossoms being used in a wide range of foods, not just teas. One of the author's favorite snacks is sakura mochi. It's a traditional sweet only available during spring. There are several variations of this sweet, but the two main ones are chomeji, which is Kanto style, and domoyoji, which is Kansai style. Both types of mochi are made and filled with sweetened red bean paste. And then they're wrapped in the leaves, which have been preserved, of the sakura tree. Pickled taste of the leaf contrasts really nicely with the sweet bean inside. So it sounds actually really good, kind of salty sweet. Another popular way to eat cherry blossoms is sakura manju. These are also filled with red bean, but instead of mochi on the outside, they are a type of steamed bun. But it doesn't just stop at traditional snacks. You can also find candies, chocolates, and other confections that are sakura-flavored, including cakes, jellies, ice cream, and anything you can imagine. This is pretty great. Apparently in Japan, Starbucks has sakura frappuccino, they have McDonald's sakura McFlurries, and Krispy Kreme sakura donuts. Wow, that's kind of incredible. I actually got a sakura-flavored Kit Kat the other day, or a cherry blossom flavored Kit Kat from a little Japanese market that was off of the 14th Street stop, so it was pretty close. I think it was on 18th, but I can find out and let you know. We're looking at all the wonderful candies. It was pretty exciting. So I'm going to take a quick break now that we've covered May Day. Up next will be Derby Day, which is one of my favorites because I love mint juleps, so we're going to be talking about mint juleps. While mint makes your mouth taste cool, and we'll hear some really fun Derby-themed songs, including this one in the background, which is Booker T and the MGs doing One Mint Julep. We're going to hear a version of that by the Clovers now, and then hear from Loretta Lynn and Jerry Garcia. Thanks for listening to Reciprocity Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn.
Was the cause of it all. said, I saw you wet. You kissed my daughter, got to wait right now. Oh, face of slaughter. I didn't know just what I was doing. I had to marry, oh, face ruin. I met julep. Oh, met julep was the cause of it all.
Extra children from a getting frisky.
Oh, a mint julep, a mint julep, a mint julep, a mint julep. What mint julep was the cause of it all?
You left me for the bright lights of the town. A country boy set out to see the world. Remember when those city lights shined down? That big old moon shines on your Kentucky. By the moon above you, how bright is it shining in your world? Some morning when you wake up all alone, just come on home to your blue Kentucky girl. Don't wait to bring great riches home to me. I need no diamond rings or fancy pearls. Just bring yourself here, all I'll ever need. That's good enough for this blue Kentucky.
Is bigger it opens. want the cup, but you don't want the race. No, you don't want the race.
Run, run, run for the roses. Quicker it opens, the sooner it closes. Man, oh, friend of mine. All good things and all good times.
Heard Run for the Roses with Jerry Garcia. Before that, we had Loretta Lynn with Blue Kentucky Girl. And before that, the Clovers with One Mint Julep. And the backing track here is, let me find it, sorry, Pancho Sanchez with another version of One Mint Julep. As we go on, I'll have more of these as our backing track, just to sort of edge us towards the Cinco de Mayo topic. This is Reciprocity Radio, and you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. So that was a little set all about Derby Day, because that is also this weekend. So we talked about May Day, we talked about Sakura Hatsumi, the Cherry Blossom Festival, and Workers' Rights Day, and now we're talking about Derby Day, and then we still have Cinco de Mayo, and also birthdays, so there's a lot to cover in the next 35 minutes, but I hope you'll enjoy what I've got prepared for you. Now let's talk about one of my favorite drinks. It does feel like a nice coincidence that my birthday is right around Derby Day, because I love mint juleps. I'm definitely a whiskey person if I had to pick a spirit. And I love mint and herbs, so I'm always for it. I'm not really for any kind of animal racing, typically, but I'm all for, you know, a chance to dress up. So hats and seersucker and... I don't know. Anyway, let's talk about the mint julep, though, because it is a wonderful drink. It is very deceptively simple and very refreshing, and we will talk also about why mint is so refreshing. Let's dig in. In the very dreams and the very dream of drinks, the vision of sweet quaffings, the bourbon and mint are lovers. In the same land they live, on the same food they are fostered. The mint dips its infant leaf into the same stream that makes the bourbon what it is. The corn grows in the level lands through which small streams meander. By the brooksides grow mint, and as the little wavelets pass, they glide up to kiss the feet of the growing mint. The mint bends to salute them. Gracious and kind it is, living only for the sake of others. The crushing of it only makes its sweetness more apparent. And like a woman's heart, it gives sweetness and aroma when bruised. Oh. Among the first to greet its spring, it comes. And beside the gurgling brooks that make music in the pastures, it lives and thrives. That is J. Sole Smith from The Mint Julep, The Very Dream of Drinks, which was published in 1949. The Mint Julep, a cocktail made from a mixture of bourbon, powdered sugar, water, and mint, is often associated with horse racing. It has been the official drink of the Kentucky Derby for almost a century. According to the website of the annual event, nearly 120,000 mint juleps are sold at Churchill Downs over the two-day race period. Like most recipes that come from the South, mint juleps have a long and often debated history. It's widely believed that the name of the drink comes from the Persian words gulab and the Arab word julab, both of which translate to rose water. The term julep was also used to refer to any type of syrupy mixed drink taken with medicine. As early as 1784, mint juleps were prescribed to soothe aching stomachs and help patients who had difficulty swallowing. A legend claims that the mint julep arrived in America when a man was searching near the Mississippi River for water to add to his bourbon. When he saw mint growing wild, he decided to drop a few leaves into his libation, and ta-da, mint julep was born. This is almost certainly a wife's tale, or as Gil Marx called it, a boobamise. Most historians agree the mint julep was developed within Virginia high society during the 1700s or early 1800s. In its early days, Virginians would sip mint juleps served in silver goblets over breakfast. During the time, they were made of brandy or rum instead of whiskey. Some say bourbon, which was readily available, was introduced to the julep, by poor Southerners who could not afford fine liquor. To this day, many enthusiasts insist that a proper julep should be made only with bourbon, given that Bourbon County is the place of the bourbon whiskey. Bourbon County. There is also a strong connection between the mint julep and the state of Kentucky. As early as 1816, silver julep cups were offered as prizes at the Kentucky County Fairs, early evidence of the state's association with the famous cocktail. It's unclear how exactly the mint julep became the star drink of the Kentucky Derby in 1938, but it comes as no surprise that this bourbon-centric cocktail was now celebrated as the beverage of choice in the state's most famous event. How the mint julep is made varies slightly from place to place and bartender to bartender. And I can put it in an aside here. It is somewhat hard to find a good one, and I don't know why, because it's sort of like an old-fashioned. It's so simple, but it is easy to mess up. There is some controversy as to whether the mint leaves should be mixed in delicately or muddled to release a stronger flavor. And then, of course, there's the whiskey in question. Does it really need to be bourbon to be a true mint julep? Quibbles aside, it's no wonder that the mint julep rose to popularity in the South. What could be more refreshing than an iced mint beverage on a humid, sweltering summer day? In an early recipe published in Dishes and Beverages of the Old South from 1913, author Martha McCulloch Williams offers a very lengthy and detailed method for creating a mint julep, and this is her recipe. This requires the very best of everything if you would have it in perfection, especially the mint and the whiskey or brandy. Choose tender, quick-growing mint, leafy and not long-stalked and coarse. Wash it very clean, taking care not to bruise it in the least, and lay in a clean cloth upon ice. Chill the spirits likewise. Put the sugar and water in a clean fruit jar and set it on the ice. Do this at least 6 hours before serving, so the sugar shall be fully dissolved. Four lumps to the large goblet is about right. With a half a goblet full of fresh cold water. At serving time, rub zest around the rim of each goblet. The goblet must be well chilled. Then half fill with dissolved sugar. Add a tablespoon of cracked ice and stand in sprigs of mint thickly around the rim. Set the goblets in the tray, then fill up with whiskey or brandy or both mixed. The mixture is best with brandy that is blended smoothly. Drop in the middle a fresh ripe strawberry or cherry or a slice of red peach and serve at once. Fruit can be left out without harm to the flavor. It is mainly for the satisfaction of the eye. But never, for any chance reason, bruise the mint. It will give it acrid flavor, most tolerable and not to be endured. To get a real old-time effect, serve with spoons in the goblets rather than straws. In dipping and sipping, more of the mint essence comes out. and besides, the clinking of the spoons is nearly as refreshing as the tinkle of the ice. If you visit Churchill Downs for the Kentucky Derby and order a julep, you will receive a ready-to-serve cocktail made with Early Times Kentucky Whiskey, the official supplier of the cocktail for over 18 years. If you're feeling extra fancy, you can order a Woodford Reserve $1,000 mint julep cup made with specially sourced exotic ingredients and served in a silver julep cup with a gold-plated straw. Each year, the net proceeds are donated to different charitable organizations, so that's at least a good reason to spend that much money on a drink. The Kentucky Derby takes place in May. If you're thinking of hosting a viewing party with mint juleps, you just need some good mints, some good whiskey, and a lot of ice and some powdered sugar. So yeah, there's a lot of lore around how to make that drink. It's deceptively simple. I did find when trying at home that powdered sugar really was the trick to get the flavor correct. Like, if I'm thinking of my ideal mint julep, the ice is definitely cracked. It's pebbly. It doesn't melt too fast or too slow. But it's refreshing. And the mint, instead of muddling, I have seen bartenders all over basically give the mint a really good clap in their hands, which doesn't bruise it, but it does seem to wake up the essential oils that are make it all taste so refreshing. So I don't know, we'll see. Maybe I'll try some mint julep testing at my house and report back on my website, which is reciprocityradio.com. That is where you can find all the recipes I've written, things I've tried, research, blog posts, other episodes of the show. You can check that out if you're interested. That's reciprocityradio.com. And now let's talk about why peppermint actually makes your mouth feel cool, because I became very curious about that since this drink is known for cooling you off in a humid summer, a humid daytime event in the South. Why is mint so refreshing? Well, there are hot and cold foods, and then there are hot and cold foods. Pepper makes you sweat, and spearmint gum feels chilly and refreshing. What's up with that? Spicy taste and refreshing taste rely on a similar mechanism, the devious trickery of your nerves. A University of Rochester researcher Anwesha Ghosh explains, nerves are the wiring of the brain carrying information in the form of electric currents. Our nervous system is built to sense changes in temperatures. A whole set of nerves running from our skin to the brain is dedicated to conveying just that information. The receptor protein that senses the change in temperature is called TRPM8, and it is found in all cold-sensing nerves. When the temperature in your mouth drops, TRPM8 changes its shape to allow calcium ions to flow into the nerve cell, and that triggers the current that goes to the brain. That's what makes you feel the sensation of being cold. But certain natural chemicals can activate TRPM8 on their own. One of them is menthol, which is what gives peppermint that cool taste. According to Ghosh, the TRPM8 was actually first discovered because it responded to menthol. It was only later scientists found out what's probably the original biological purpose, which is to react to temperature change. Your body has reason to respond to anything very hot or very cold in temperature, but not so much reason to respond to something like menthol, which is a natural occurring oil. Spicy foods work the same way, but because of different receptor, VR1 receptors are meant to detect heat, but they also are activated by capsaicin, which is the chemical in chili peppers. It's what makes things spicy. So because of menthol and capsaicin are both activated by your skin's, they both activate your skin's temperature sensors, they can also make you feel numb. So in addition to giving a flavor dimension, it also works great as a sort of painkiller. It's interesting. A while back, I talked about it on one of my shows, I'm not sure which one, went to a wonderful garden in the city that's underground, and it's called, I have to think of what it's called after this break, but it was amazing, and I did end up eating some herbs that did make your mouth completely numb. Eat some, just like little tiny leaves, you chew on them and then like taste something and it tastes completely changes the flavor. I'll figure that out and tell you after this break. We have a few more songs and about 24 more minutes here on Reciprocity Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Let's start getting into our wonderful set for Cinco de Mayo. We're going to hear from Jalisco band, Freddy Fender, who is Mexican, and Willie Nelson with Carlos Santana. See you in a bit.
No está aquí. Where's my pal and where's my friend? All good things must have an end. Sad things and nothings, on and on they go. I guess he went to Mexico. They all went to Mexico. Buenos dias, got to go. Tengo que obedecer ser mi corazón. They all went to Mexico. Slow. They both went to Mexico. Where's my sweetie? Where's the face that lit dark corners every place? She put up with me a long time, you know, and then she had to go to Mexico. They all went to Mexico. Buenos dias, got to go. Tango que yo better ser mi. Where's my brown dog? Where's my hound? He liked my truck, he hung around, but he's a canine Romeo, and I guess he went to Mexico. Where's that woman, so sweet, so mean? Her heart was cautious, her mind was keen. She was always looking for the Picadillo. I hope she went to Mexico. They all went to Mexico. Buenos dias, got to go. Tango que yo better ser mi corazón. Where's December's happy crew with German bikes and signed cars too?
All right. We're hearing Willie Nelson with Carlos Santana. They all went to Mexico. Before that, No Está Aquí from Freddie Fender. And before that, La Batalla de... I'm going to forget. Cinco de Mayo. I almost said it in Italian. Cinque de Mayo by Jalisco Band. And yeah, this is Reciprocity Radio. We're going to try to catch us up. We had 4 to 5 holidays celebrated here in this weekend, including my birthday. And let's talk about Cinco de Mayo, which, as far as I understand, is much more of an American kind of thing than the actual Independence Day that Mexico does celebrate. Cinco de Mayo, or the 5th of May, is a holiday that celebrates the date of the Mexican Army's 1862 victory over France at the Battle of Puebla during the Franco-Mexican War. And the day, which falls on Sunday, May 5th, is also known as the Battle of Puebla Day, which is a relatively minor holiday in Mexico, but in the United States, Cinco de Mayo has evolved into a commemoration of Mexican culture and heritage, particularly in the areas with large Mexican-American populations. Cinco de Mayo history. In 1861, Benito Juarez, a lawyer and member of the indigenous Zapotec tribe, was elected president of Mexico. At the time, the country was in financial ruin after years of internal strife, and the new president was forced to default on debt payments to the European governments. In response, France, Britain, and Spain sent naval forces to Veracruz, Mexico, demanding repayment. Britain and Spain negotiated with Mexico and then withdrew their forces. France, however, ruled by Napoleon III, decided to use the opportunity to carve an empire out of Mexican territory. In late 1861, a well-armed French fleet stormed Veracruz, landing a large force of troops and driving President Juarez and his government into retreat. A certain success would come swiftly. 6,000 French troops under the general Charles Latrille Faye Lauren says, I can't not speak French. We're sent out to attack the Pueblo de Los Angeles, a small town in central Mexico, And from his headquarters in the North Waters, rounded up a ragtag force of 2,000 men. Many of them are indigenous Mexicans or of mixed ancestry, and sent them to Puebla. But the vastly outnumbered and poorly supplied Mexicans, led by Texas-born General Ignacio Zaragoza, fortified the town and prepared for the French assault. On May 5th, 1862, Lorenzo and his army, supported by heavy artillery, came before the city of Puebla and led an assault. The battle lasted from daybreak to early evening, when the French finally retreated after losing 500 soldiers. Fewer than 100 Mexicans had been killed through the battle. Within Mexico, Cinco de Mayo is primarily observed in the state of Puebla, where Zaragoza's unlikely victory occurred, although other parts of the country also take part in the celebration. Traditions include military parades, recreations of the Battle of Puebla, and other festive events. For many Mexicans, however, May 5th is a day like any other. It's not a federal holiday, and offices and banks remain open. Sorry about that. Backing track again. So why do we celebrate this in the United States? Cinco de Mayo is widely interpreted as a celebration of Mexican culture and heritage, particularly in areas with substantial Mexican-American populations. Chicano activists raised awareness of the holiday in the 1960s, in part because they identified with the victory of indigenous Mexicans, such as Juarez, over European invaders. Today, revelers mark the occasion with parades, parties, mariachi music, Mexican folk dancing, and traditional foods such as tacos and mole poblano. Some of the largest festivals are held in Los Angeles, Chicago, and Houston, Texas. And this confusion here is it's not Mexican Independence Day. It's just a battle that they won independence. Many people outside of Mexico think that Cinco de Mayo is the celebration of Mexican independence, which was declared more than 50 years before the Battle of Puebla. Independence Day in Mexico, or Dia de los de la Independencia. Oh, my Italian has ruined my Spanish. I apologize. Independence Day is celebrated in Mexico on September 16th. It's the anniversary of the revolutionary priest Miguel Hidalgo y Costello's famous Grito de Dolores, or the Cry of Dolores, a call to arms that amounted to the declaration of war against the Spanish colonial government in 1810. That's what you know now. Now you know it's not Mexican Independence Day. It is actually just the anniversary of a battle, but it's wonderful to celebrate Mexican heritage and partake in wonderful Mexican food. I think I'm going to do that after this. Maybe go over to Los Hermanos Taqueria, which is not too far away from here, but it's one of my favorites. And I feel bad for rushing through Cinco de Mayo. I could talk about Mexican food all day and eat it all day. It's one of my absolute favorite cuisines by far. And I just absolutely love it. It's so fresh and delicious. It's one of my favorite things to cook. But we have to finish up. I have 10 minutes, and I haven't talked about birthdays. It was mine Friday, and I started to wonder, why the heck do we eat cake, and what does it have to do with birthdays? So let's find out as we wrap up the show here on Radio Free Brooklyn. A party, it is not a party without a cake, but ever wonder why? Most people like cake, and I don't know, there doesn't really need to be an excuse, but, you know, it seems to be a thing. Baked goods on birthdays. I made something to bring to my own birthday. So let's find out why. This is the whole thing about having sweets. It's believed that the first actual birthday cake was made in Germany in the Middle Ages. Germans would celebrate children's birthday with cake, calling it the celebration Kinderfest, so Kinder's child. Cakes originally were coarse, bread-like, and later became a much sweeter version, which was called Geburtstagorten. In the 17th century, birthday cakes were made more elaborate with details like icing, layers, and decorations like flowers. However, these kind of cakes were only affordable for the wealthier upper class due to high-priced ingredients. In the 18th century, food and baking utensils became more accessible and therefore affordable. With that, the price of cake went down and the number of cakes produced went up considerably. Now, the big question is, why do we have candles in cake? One theory is that the history of putting candles on cake came from ancient Greece. The Greeks would make round cakes to honor Artemis, the goddess of the moon, The lit candles on the cake represented the glow of the moon, and the smoke from the candles carried their prayers and wishes to the gods who lived in the skies. Some scholars believe the tradition actually started in Germany, again, where a candle was placed on the cake to represent the light of life. Today, most Western cultures celebrate birthdays with cake, lit candles, and birthday songs. The number of candles usually represents the age of the person celebrated. Many believe that a silent wish must be made while blowing the candles out with one breath, and the wish cannot be told to anyone else or will not come true. So now you know a little bit more about the history of cake. Not quite the answer I was looking for, but that's okay. No excuses for cake. That's what I feel. So anyway, thank you for listening to Reciprocity Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. It's my pleasure to be here. I hope you enjoyed what you heard. If you like what you heard, consider donating. Radio Free Brooklyn is a 401c nonprofit. Any donations you make are tax deductible, and we are volunteer-based and doing all kind of fun things, so please check out radiofreebrooklyn.org for more information on our programs, on our events, on other shows. We always are having new shows added to the lineup, so it's really exciting, and you should just check it out. You can sign up for the newsletter on radiofreebrooklyn.org as well, so give that a click. You can check out past episodes from me, Amanda, and Reciprocity Radio on reciprocityradio.com, where there will be recipes, videos, blog posts, all kinds of things, including past episodes. So if you're curious about this show, go ahead and go over to reciprocityradio.com. And I, of course, also link to Radio Free Brooklyn. So thanks so much for tuning in. I'm going to take us out with two songs that include birthdays and hope that you will enjoy them. We have Your Sweet and Shiny Eyes from Bonnie Raitt, which somehow combines birthdays in Mexico and margaritas into one song, and Birthday Girl from The Replacements. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next Sunday here at 5 p.m. on Radio Free Brooklyn.
You're sweet.
she won't come through. Hate the sad face on your lucky day. Birthday gal, did you wish yet? Can you handle the turning? The candles are burning. That you had to blow. Hair falls down all around the eyes, the clothes. She might wear them earrings, but she won't wear the clothes. Or hang them up with all the ones that don't fit no more. I thought this was a party. Come on, let's lighten up. No one gets a slice until we make the first cut. No, the lights down, she's ready now, and this is birthday gal, did you wish yet? Can you handle the turning, the candle?